everyone, and welcome to the Live Through Jesus podcast with Courtney Gilmore. On this episode, we're going to talk about experiential knowledge and head knowledge. This is Judges 1 and 2. So there's a big difference between having an actual relationship with someone and then just knowing about them, right? If someone were to come up to me and say, hey, do you know this guy? And I'd be like, well, I mean, I know about him. I've heard of his name before, but I don't really know him. Or, yeah, he works with me, but we don't really hang out. Or maybe I would say, yeah, we've been around each other. We're around each other all day at work, but I'm not around him in his personal life. So I don't really know anything specific about him. I just kind of know his personality or whatever. Or if it were to be like, yeah, we hang out a lot, but we keep our distance on personal things. Like, we don't really talk about, you know, really personal things. That's not someone that I trust with those types of things. And then we have our really, really close friends, right? So we know the difference in different types of relationships and different types of knowledge about other people. So this is what we're going to talk about today. What does it look like when we have just kind of a superficial knowledge of God, a head knowledge of God, and how does that play out in our real lives? And what about if we get a real personal experience with Him? If we have a personal relationship with Him, and how does that play out in our lives? So that's what we're going to look at, two generations of Israelites, and see the difference between those people that have had daily experiences with Him, people that have had Him work in their lives, and they're constantly communicating with Him and dealing with Him, and then those who just have been told about Him, but they haven't really had any experiences of their own. We're going to see what their lives look like and the differences. So the first chapter of Judges, we're going to breeze by because that is not the focus of this lesson. It's kind of more a history lesson, how they got to the place that we're going to talk about in the entire book of Judges. And so as we begin the book of Judges, I want to tell you real quickly that Judges doesn't mean what we think it means. It doesn't mean making decisions or discernment or wisdom or anything like that. It means judges in the sense of like vindicators, someone that is exacting justice. And so these judges are people that judge the other nations for their treatment of the Israelites and then save the Israelites from really themselves, but it looks as if they're saving them from that other nation. And so this first chapter tells us, their history and kind of how they got there. The second chapter is what we're going to focus on today. And then beginning next week, we'll just start going through the judges. So this first chapter talks about the things that happened after Joshua died. And we know that when Moses died, he made Joshua his successor, but Joshua made no one his successor. And the presumption is that they're going to have more local governments now because he's given them each their own allotted land. Each tribe has their own land. And so they're going to kind of govern more locally. They don't have someone leading them into the promised land, leading them into war. And so they're going to govern more locally. And when Joshua gave them this land, he said, yeah, there are still some people left to conquer in the land. That is true. But we don't need this huge army anymore. You can do this by yourselves in your own territories. You can get another tribe to help you, but we're not going to do this big thing anymore. Everybody's going to go to their own places. But he told them, when you go to your own land, don't forget to follow God's laws. Make sure that you remember all the things that God has taught you, because I'm about to die and you're about to go to your own places, and I need you to follow God's ways. And also, they were supposed to get all of the foreigners from their land. It's not like they were just going to go there and live. They were supposed to continue to fight until they rid the people totally of their land, And God said he would help them. God is going to help them do this, but they just need to keep asking him for help. Keep working at it. Keep fighting until all the people are gone. That was their charge. And so after Joshua died, the people go to presumably the priests and say, ask God who's supposed to fight first, how this is supposed to go. And we believe they probably cast lots and the lot fell on Judah. And so Judah was going to go fight the people first. And remember that Judah got the whole southern part of Israel, except for Simeon got some land within his land. And so Judah's land surrounds Simeon. And so basically they have the whole southern portion of Israel. And so he asked Simeon, because Simeon's land is kind of his land, their land is together. He says, hey, will you come and fight with me? And so they begin this fight for eradicating the people from their land. And so I want to read you, I'm not going to read you at all of chapter one, but I want to read you a couple of verses that talk about their very first fight, because it's actually kind of funny. It's pretty entertaining, and it's a detail that we don't have before. So this is Judges 1, verse 4. Then Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand. They killed 10,000 men in Bezek. They found Adonai Bezek in Bezek, and they fought against him. Now, Adonai just means Lord or ruler. And so this is the king of Bezek. So I'm going to read it like king of Bezek every time they say Adonai Bezek. And so they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And then the king of Bezek fled, and they pursued him, and they caught him, and they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. And then the king of Bezek said, after they did this to him, he said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. And then they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. And so this is just kind of hilarious. Either all the kings did this at this time, or at least he had done this to all of the kings that he had defeated. He cut their thumbs and their big toes off because this made them no longer to be warriors. They could no longer fight him or anyone else because they can't wield a sword with no thumbs, and they can't run with no big toes. They can't stand stable on their feet. And so this debilitates them as a warrior. It also shows that they are defeated. This is a visible sign of their defeat. Everyone that sees them knows, oh, they've been defeated by someone. They lost a war because their thumbs and their big toes are gone. And so even he says, I kind of deserve this. This is what I do to other people. And now God is repaying me. He even counts God as his person that is repaying him. So he realizes that the Israelites were acting on behalf of God and that this is kind of what he deserves. And so it's sort of crazy. Also, this shame would normally be carried because everyone would see that you've been defeated, but he doesn't carry the shame very long because they carry him off to Jerusalem and then he dies there of these wounds. So a strange turn of events there. That's their first battle that we get to hear about. Then they just go on. They go on to telling us what all of the next battles are. And so it says the next thing they do is go to Jerusalem, and they fight against the people in Jerusalem. They defeat them, and then they burn that city. That's what this next verse says. But later on in the chapter, it tells us that Benjamin, who also shares Jerusalem with Judah, so Judah has the southern part and Benjamin has the northern part. And so it tells us that Benjamin does not defeat the Jebusites that live there. And so he lives amongst the Jebusites in his territory, but presumably the people are defeated in the southern part because we know that Judah burned that part of the city. Now, someone could have moved to it later, but that is what we know from this chapter. Then the next thing that we learn is it just kind of reiterates the land of Hebron and Debir, where Caleb defeats the three kings of Hebron. And so I guess it's just saying, you know, Judah is defeating all of these people. And remember, Caleb already defeated some of the people in Hebron and Debir. And so it just goes through that list again. And we're not going to go through that because that was in Joshua 15, if you want to go look that up. But we talked about it already. The next thing that we learned, though, is something that we didn't know and haven't heard about since Numbers. And it was only a small little passage. In Numbers, Moses tells his father-in-law and their family, he says, hey, don't go back to your land. Stay with us. God's about to give us this great land, and I'd like you to come with us. And they're like, no, really, we just need to go back home. And then Moses says, no, I really want you to stay. These people have been in Egypt all of this time. They don't know any land other than Egypt. You know this land. You've traveled it. And we would like you to come and help us. Plus, again, God is going to give us great things, and we want you to be a benefit of it. These are his in-laws, Moses' in-laws. Well, now, here in verse 16 of Judges 1, we find out that Moses' in-laws did stay with him, and they've moved in to the land of Judah. And as his, first of all, they're his family members, his by marriage, because this is his wife's family. But also, we think that these people descended from Abraham's wife, Keturah. And so these would be Abraham's family, if that were to be the case, if this is correct that they descended from these people. But either way, God has made provisions for people that are foreigners to live with them as long as they adopt the Israelites' ways and vow to worship their God. And so they get to live there. They're not eradicated as foreigners. They've been adopted into the Israelite family. And so they're living there with Judah. The next thing we find out is that they are fighting the Philistines, the coastal people on the Mediterranean coast. And it says that Judah defeated three of the five Philistine kings. And it says, but they weren't able to defeat all of them because they had iron chariots. And it's not really that they couldn't defeat them. God had promised to help them defeat all of the people and bring them all out of the land. But they didn't stick with it long enough. They're like, these chariots are fast. They get around on these plains. We don't have this equipment. We fought these three kings. This is hard. And we're kind of done. And so they let them remain. And we find out in chapter 2 that all of the Philistine kings have their own land back. So they don't even keep these three areas for very long. But it tells us that they defeated those places. They defeated all of the people in the hill country, it says, and just not all of the people in the lowlands. And then the rest of the chapter goes through each tribe and tells how each tribe defeated a lot of the people, but the towns, the specific areas where they allowed the nations to continue to live. And some of these people didn't defeat them initially, but when they got stronger, they submitted to them to forced labor. And then someone like Asher never defeats the people, and they never submit them to forced labor. And then also the land of Dan, which we already knew, the Amorites basically just run them out. And Joshua gives them this land, but they never defeat the Amorites that are living there. And so eventually they just give up and they go up to the north and they take land in Manasseh's land and they name it by the tribe of Dan. And so that's just all that it tells us there in chapter 1. Chapter 2 is where we get into the point of this lesson. And so I'm going to read you most of chapter 2, if not all of it, beginning with just the first several verses. And so this is Judges chapter 2, verse 1. And it says, then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. you shall tear down their altars, but you haven't obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Therefore, I said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare to you. So it was when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all of the children of Israel that the people lifted their voices and wept. And then it says that they named this place Bochim, which means weepers, after their crying there in this place. And then they made a sacrifice to the Lord. And so let's break this down before we move on and go any further. First of all, anytime that it says the angel of the Lord instead of an angel of the Lord, it's talking. Some people believe this means Jesus, the pre-incarnate Jesus. The God is speaking to them. He is the messenger. So when it says the angel of the Lord, if you're reading the New King James Version, some of those versions that capitalize the pronouns whenever they talk about God or the Lord, then you will see angel capitalized here because they believe that this is Jesus. Now, some of the other, just for information, why like the NIV, the ESV don't capitalize the pronouns when they're used, when they're speaking about God and saying he, is for this exact purpose, because they're not sure if this is God, Jesus, or if this is just a messenger. It could just be that he's speaking with the authority of God and he speaks in the first person because he's God's messenger. That's what an angel is. And he's speaking the words of God to the people. And so he speaks in the first person as if he is God because he's been given that authority. And so we don't really know. You can make up your own mind on what you believe on that, but that's just a little bit of information as you read the Bible and when you see this phrase. And so what God tells them, that's what we do know, is that these are God's words, and God comes to the people and he says, hey, I led you out of Egypt and I swore to bring you into this land, and I did bring you into this land, and I said that I would never ever break my covenant with you, but it looks like you want to forfeit your inheritance because you are not doing what I told you to do. I told you to eradicate these people from your land. And you seem to be satisfied to let them settle here. You didn't continue to fight. You started and then you just gave up. You decided, not worth it. I don't really want to keep fighting these people. I'd really just like to settle in my land. And so you just left them here. And so, yes, I made a promise to give you this land, but I also promised you that if you left the people here, we read this last week in chapter 23 or 24 of Joshua, that if you do leave the people here, then I won't help you drive them out anymore. If you decide that you want to let them live amongst you, then I'll let you do that. But what's going to happen is these people are going to continue to be a problem for you. And their gods are going to be a snare to you. They're going to be a temptation for you always now because you didn't do what I said. You didn't get rid of them like I told you to do. And that's why I told you to do it, because I knew that their gods were going to tempt you to disobey me. And then I was going to have to do more than, you know, just leave them here. And so I just brought up a couple of verses. If you do subscribe to the lesson on Substack, you will see the verses there that I just brought up, but I'll tell you what they say. Some of the things that the Bible says that are a snare to us, okay? And so in Proverbs, it tells us a lot of things that are a snare to us. And I'll go ahead and tick those verses off so that y'all don't have to subscribe if you don't want to. Proverbs 18:7, Proverbs 20:25, 22:24 and 25, and then 29:25. All of these verses tell us the things that can be a snare to us. One of the things is our mouth. It says it can become a problem for you. It can cause you to fall. Making vows, rash vows, and then wishing you didn't. That's a specific thing that can be a snare to us. Also, our friends, the people that we hang out with, if we hang out with angry people, if we hang out with people that are not doing what God wants us to do, then those people can be a snare to us. And then the last thing is having more of a fear for man than you do for God. That will be a snare to you, not placing your faith in God because you're too afraid of what men think. That will be a snare to you. And then in 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 10, it says, "Now godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it's certain we can carry nothing out. Having food and clothing, with these things we should be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation." That's a snare. "And into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in distraction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. For which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness, and pierce themselves through with many sorrows." And so money can be a great snare to us, right? So while we're seeing what was a snare to those people, their idols that they might worship, these are things that we might put above God, something that would be an idol to us, our own words, our own friends, money. And then our desire to be liked, what other people think of us, all of these things can be snares to us. So if we want to take caution from the Israelites and not allow these things to remain living with us, these friends, we don't want to keep them in our friend group and in tight-knit circles if they're going to be a snare to us. If we know that our words can be a snare to us, then we need to get them under control. Don't let those things continue to be said by you. If you know that money is something that can be a snare to you, then you need to figure out how to not let that, you know, take root in your daily living. Don't let it live with you. If you know that what other people think it is more of a concern to you than what God thinks, then you have to figure out how to not let that live with you so that that doesn't become a snare to you. So just while we're looking at them, we need to see what is in our lives that we might need to get away from us so that it doesn't become a snare to us. So then we go on and see that they're crying, they're sad, they seem to realize what they've done, and they seem to be sad about it, and they make a sacrifice to God. But God says, "I would have really rather that you just obey me in the first place. This sacrifice really means nothing if you don't obey." And his word tells us that also. In Psalm 40, 6 through 8, it said, "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, God did not desire. My ears you've opened. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you didn't require." And then verse 8 says, "I delight to do your will, O God, and your law is within my heart." That is what God desires. And then in Psalm 51, 16 and 17, it's more explicit and tells us what God really desires. It says, "For you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offerings. The sacrifice of God are broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you won't despise." What God really wants is repentance. And so these people look like that right now. They look as if they feel bad about what they've done. And God said, "I want that more. More than your sacrifice, because a sacrifice is something you can do whether your heart is in it or not. What I really want is for you to see that what you've done is wrong and do something about it." But then we find out that they don't. They don't ever eradicate the people from their land, and they do become a problem to them. And so let's continue reading in Judges 2, beginning in verse 6. And it says, "When Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land." This is just given the history. This is what had happened. And it says, "So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord, which he had done for Israel." So what that's saying is it's going back to the Joshua generation, and it's saying that entire generation, they follow God. The ones that had seen the great works of the Lord, which he had done for Israel, that generation followed God. And then it just tells us that Joshua died and they buried him. And then in verse 10, it says, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who didn't know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. And so this is the purpose of this lesson. And we'll talk about it in real detail about how it pertains to us in the end of this lesson. But what they're saying is that the generation that had seen all of God's great works, that generation served him forever. This generation of Israelites, this Joshua generation, remember, they had watched everything that had gone on with their fathers. They saw how their fathers had to wander around in the wilderness for 40 years because they were not willing to obey God and trust in him to help them defeat the people that lived in the promised land. And so they didn't get to go in. They knew this. And so all this time, they're in the desert waiting for their turn to go in and take the land. And when they get that chance, they don't make the same mistake that their fathers made. They go in and they follow God to the T. And every single time that someone goes astray and doesn't follow God, they take care of it immediately. God will bring it to their attention and they deal with that person and they eradicate that sin and they commit themselves fully to God again. This happens every time with this generation because they are committed to God. And the reason that they're so committed is because they saw what it looked like when their fathers weren't committed. And then also every time that they trust in God, God comes through. They have personal experience with God's power. They see how he fed them in the desert. He made sweet bread fall from the sky to feed them. I mean, he literally was feeding them himself. And they saw that. So they had an experience with God there in the desert. They saw how God protected them and how God fought for them and how their small army defeated this great number of people, all these different nations and their armies in the new land. And so they had full experience with God's power, his provision, his protection. And then he also was handing down his laws to them. And so he was teaching them, he was guiding them, he was bringing them into the land. And so they had tons of personal experiences with him. And so that's what they're saying. They're saying that generation that had personal experiences with God, experiential knowledge of him, they served him all of their days. That makes sense. They really truly knew who God was. But their children, who didn't have to fight for this inheritance, who just got it handed to them, they had no experiences with God. All they had was the stories that their dads handed down. And so what they really had was head knowledge of God. They knew about him, but they did not know him. So it's like what I told you before. If someone were to come to me and say, do you know this person? And I say, well, I know of him, but I don't know him. And that's what these people had. They just had handed down knowledge. They lived in this land. They didn't live with no food and have God feed them. This land was abundant. When they could just walk out there and get fruit from the vine, right? The land was already given to them. Now, the land was like that for their fathers also when they came into it, but they knew God gave it to them. They knew that this land had been someone else's and God gave it to them. And the kids are just like, yeah, this is dad's land and I get to go out there and get whatever I want. This is kind of what it's like for, if you will see, a person who struggled, they came from nothing, they worked their way up in their business, or they started a business, and now they're very successful, but then their kids inherit this and they don't know what it took to work for that. They don't know what it took to get to that place. And so they don't have that. They don't have even the fortitude to work hard and to do good because they've never had to do that. Everything's been handed to them. And so if everything's been handed to you, you don't quite know what to do with it. And that's what has happened to these kids. But they don't know God. They don't know God like their fathers knew him. They just have this handed down knowledge of him. And that doesn't compel them to have faith in the Lord. That doesn't compel them to follow him because they don't know him well enough to follow him. They just know what they've been told. And so we're going to move on and read in Judges 2, beginning in verse 11. And it says, "Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord, and they served Baal and Ashtoreth." And so Baal was the war god that all of the other nations served. And the Ashtoreths are gods of love, fertility, things like that. And so it says, because they weren't devoted to God, because they weren't committed like their fathers were, then they were easily ensnared. They were easily drawn away by these other gods. And they began to worship those gods. They turned away from the Lord, their God, who had brought them into this land, out of the land of Egypt, and they turned to these other gods. And so it says, in verse 14, "The anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. And so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn to them. They were greatly distressed." And so, just as God had promised them that if they did not follow him and get all of the people out, that he wouldn't help them drive them out and then they would become a snare, he also promised that if they fell into that temptation and they worshiped these other gods, then he was going to turn against them. He said in the last lesson, the one that we talked about last week, he said, "If you worship other gods, then all of the good that I've done towards you, I'm going to quit doing, and I'm instead going to do evil towards you." And so he said, all of the things that I promised you would happen have happened. Promised I would bring you into the land, and I did that. And so I also promised that if you didn't keep fighting and get these people out of the land, I wouldn't fight for you and get them out. And then they would be a snare to you. And if you fell into that trap and you worship other gods, then I would turn against you. I would allow your enemies to overtake you. And it says here, he says, he let the plunderers plunder and he sold them to their enemies. And so he's doing what he told them he was going to do. And that is where the whole rest of the book of Judges comes into play. And so in verse 16, it says, "The Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them." And so what we see happening is beginning in verse, I can't see it. I gotta put my glasses on to see what the verse is because it's tiny. Verse 18 says, "When the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of that judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass, when the judge was dead, that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings, nor from their stubborn ways. And then the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. And he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and have not listened to my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died, so that through them I might test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of the Lord to walk in them as their fathers kept them or not. And so, that is what the whole rest of this book is going to be about. It's going to be this cycle of how they worship other gods and God is angry with them and he allows them to be oppressed by some other nation. And then God feels sorry for them. They cry out to him. He feels sorry for them and he raises up this judge, and this judge saves them from those people. He vindicates them and exacts justice on that other nation. And then all the days of that judge, they seem to be on the straight and narrow. They seem like they're doing good. But as soon as the judge dies, then they go back to their ways. And it says it's even worse than the time before. Then they follow other gods, and the whole cycle starts all over again. In the ESV version, it says that they whore after other gods. Basically, they sell themselves just like a whore. They just for the temporary pleasure or the things that they're going to get from this, they give themselves over to these other gods. They allow themselves to be unfaithful to their God by being with these other gods. They betray him. And then just like a habitual unfaithful spouse, right? Someone that you just never can trust. It's like they cheat on you and you think that they're going to stay and everything is good. And then something happens and they do it again. And then again, and then again, and then again. That's how he describes this nation of Israel. They are just constantly going back to their ways. It's just a cycle of betrayal and difficulty and then forgiveness and help and a time of union and rest. And then it all happens again. And so that's what this entire book is going to be about. The judges that God raises up and how the nation of Israel does this cycle of betrayal and judges and rest and does it again and a new judge. And so that's where we're going to go next week. But I'm going to read the first four verses of chapter 3 now, because it goes along with this testing of Israel and how the Israelites continuously fail the test. And so in the beginning of verse 3, it says, "Now these are the nations that the Lord left, that he might test Israel by them, that is, all who had not known any of the wars in Canaan. This was only so that the generations of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who hadn't formerly known it." And then I'll tell you what the nations are in a minute, but go down to verse 4, and it says, "These were left that they might test Israel by them to know whether they would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses." And so the nations that they left were these factions within the midst of them that they named at the end of chapter 1. And then it says they also left all of the Philistial nations, the five kings of the Philistines on the coast, and then also many of those in the north, which would be now like the Lebanon, Syria area. They left those too. So they never quite defeated the northern territory, and they never quite defeated the people on the Mediterranean Sea. And then there were just some people living amongst the middle of their land, okay? And so it says God left those people there to test them, to see how will they do with these people there with them. How are they going to deal with that, right? Are they going to fall into temptation, or are they going to obey the Lord? That's what he wants to know. And so he leaves these people. And here's what the interesting thing is. He says, I'm going to leave these people to test them. All who had not known any of the wars in Canaan. This was only so that that generation of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who hadn't formerly known it. And so this made me think about those people that I was talking about before, like how the dad had to work hard to get his money, but then he created this easy life for his kids, and they had no fortitude. They had no ability to work. They had no way of knowing. And it sounds like that's kind of what God is saying, is like their fathers knew war and their fathers trusted me. But these people haven't known war, and so maybe I'm going to have to teach them war so that they'll rely on me. Maybe I'm going to have to let them be oppressed so that they'll rely on me. And so that made me think about that quote, right, where it talks about tough times create strong men and strong men create easy times, and then those easy times create weak men. And then those weak men create tough times, right? That's kind of the cycle that we're seeing, because their fathers were in tough times. They had to travel a long ways. They had to fight hard for their land. And so they were like those men that you know, work hard for their fortune, and they're relying on God for that. And so their spirit is strong. These fathers' spirit is strong. They are connected with God. They are relying on Him daily for their food, for their protection, for their provision, for His power to bring them into this land. And so their spirit is strong, but they created easy times for their kids. They just handed this inheritance to them, and the kids don't know what to do with it. They don't have to work hard to keep their relationship with God. They're not committed to Him. Times are easy for them, and they're weak. Their spirit is weak. They have no connection with God, and they're not committed to Him. And so they fall into this temptation, and now God is going to have to create tough times for them so that they will come back to Him, so they will cry out to Him. And then He will send them a judge, and the judge will save them. This is the cycle. And so we obviously do not want to fall into that cycle, but what do we have to do? We have to be like the Joshua generation instead of their children. And how do we do that? Well, we have to know Him by experience, like that generation knew Him. Our knowledge can't just be head knowledge. It can't be superficial knowledge, just knowing about Him, just kind of, you know, surface knowledge. It has to be deep knowledge of Him in order for us to stay faithful, because that superficial knowledge is not going to keep us faithful to Him. We have to really, truly know Him. And not only do we have to know Him deeply, but we have to know Him personally. It can't be a knowledge that's handed down from our parents or from the church. It has to be our own personal experiences. And so if we came to know God in adulthood, then we have had at least one experience with Him, right? We had one experience that made us say, I want to know that God. I want to follow that God. Something about Him made you want to do that. And so if you're that person that came to know Him late in life and you've had one experience with Him, you can't let that be your only experience with Him. You have to continue to get to know Him, to continue to have experiences with Him, right? That's the only way that you will have a deep knowledge of Him. And then if you are a child who's grown up in the church, whose parents taught you about God, but then you're like that generation that came after Joshua's generation. They told them about their experiences, but they didn't know them themselves. And so you've been told things by your parents and by your church But you have to make that personal. You have to make it your own. You have to develop your own personal relationship with God. That's the only way that you're going to stay faithful to Him. Because otherwise, His rules are just arbitrary rules. You don't know why He has given you these rules. You don't know His heart behind them, right? And so you're gonna fall away. You're not going to stay close to Him if you don't have deep, deep knowledge of Him. And so we have to work for this. This isn't a passive relationship. We have to work to stay close to God, to know more about Him, right? And how do you get to know a person? Say that you do just know about a person, but you decide, I like what I see, and I'd like to know more. How do you get to know them? Well, there's two ways to get to know that person, right? You can spend time with them personally, and then you can talk to people that know them. So you go to someone that knows them and you say, hey, tell me more about this person. I've seen a little bit about them. I'm observing a few things and I'd like to know more about them. Tell me about them from your own experience, right? Tell me what you know about them. And then you have personal experiences with them. You begin hanging out with them. You begin listening to them, talking with them, that doing things with them, seeing how they act and react and the things that they do. That's how you get to know them. You talk to them, you tell them personal things about you, and you learn personal things about them. That's how you really get to know someone, right? So it's the same thing with God. This is what we have to do with Him. We have to talk to other people that know Him, talk to people that are believers, and ask them, what do you know about God? Tell me the things that you know about God. I want to know Him more. Tell me your experiences with Him. Teach me His word. And so that means going to church and spending time with other people that know Him, listening to them, letting them teach you about their own personal experiences and about the things that they know about Him. And then you have to spend time with Him yourself, which means reading His word, letting Him talk to you, right? And then talking to Him, praying to Him, and listening to how His spirit communes with your spirit. And so this is how you get to know Him. Spend time with Him. Walk in His ways. Learn how He acts and begin to act like Him. That's how it is whenever we are hanging out with someone, right? The more we hang out with them, the more we get to know what they're like. And the more we begin to kind of act like them without even realizing it, right? I have this thing, my family makes fun of me because there's certain people that I hang out with and they talk in a certain way. And when I'm around them for very long, I begin to talk like them. And so I adopt their just way of speaking, and they can come in and say, oh, you've been hanging out with so-and-so, right? Because I can hear the way you're talking. I do this for some reason more than apparently other people do this. And you can also just begin to act like them. You know, you see how they handle a certain situation, and without really even thinking about it, you just kind of naturally do what they did because you've been around them so long that you begin to adopt their ways. That's what it's like to become more like Him. The more we know Him, the more we act like Him. And then the more we know Him, the more we understand Him. And so we want to follow His ways because we get them. You know, people will fall away because they don't understand Him. So I want to read you what it says in Luke 8. This is a parable that Jesus gives to the people. It's a perfect explanation of this progression of knowledge towards God. This progression of when we just kind of, you know, hear about Him and what we do with that knowledge afterwards, whether it grows or it doesn't, how deep our relationship is with Him. And so this is Luke 8, beginning in verse 5. And it says, this is a parable. And so it's it's giving the people a situation that they might know about and then relating it to God. Kind of how I was doing a while ago when I was saying the rich man and how he dealt with his money and how he got rich and then what happens with his kids. And then I related that to God. That's what this is going to do. And so this is verse 5, and it says, a sower went out to sow his seed. As he sowed, some fell by the wayside, and it was trampled down, and the birds of the air devoured it. Some fell on rock, and as soon as it sprang up, it withered away because it lacked moisture. Some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up with it and choked it. But others fell on good ground, sprang up, and yielded a crop of 100-fold. When he had said these things, he cried, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." And then the disciples asked him, "What does this parable mean?" And then you skip down to verse 11, and he says, this is what the parable means. The seed is the word of God. Those by the wayside are the ones that hear. But then the devil comes, and he takes away the word out of their hearts, lest they should believe and become saved. So these are the people that hear about God, but then they either forget about what they hear and they just don't care about it anymore, or they reject it outright. Satan makes them not care about him, and they don't accept anything that they hear. And so this would be like the relationship with the person where we see something and then we just never get to know them. We just never know any more about them. Verse 13, but the ones on the rock are those who, when they hear, they receive the word with joy, but these have no root, who believe for a while, and in time of temptation, they fall away. Now the ones that fell among the thorns are those who, when they've heard, they go out, and they're choked with cares, riches, and pleasures of life, and they bring no fruit to maturity. But the ones that fell on the good ground are those who, having heard the word with the noble and good heart, keep it and bear fruit with patience. And so the ones that they're saying fell by the rocks, and it takes no root. So you hear about God and you like it and you accept it, but then it never takes root in you. And so you have this superficial knowledge of God all of this time. It's just on the surface, and it never gets to take root in you. And then when times get hard and things don't make sense to you, maybe you do read the Bible, or maybe you see the things that are happening in the world, and you're like, I don't like this God, because the things that I'm seeing don't make sense. I don't want to follow those rules. So you accept him because it looks like he can do good things for you. And then you realize, no, I don't like these rules. These rules are stupid. And I'm not going to follow them. I'm going to go my own way. So you're tempted not to follow him. Or maybe you see bad things happening in the world and you say, I don't like this God. He doesn't make sense to me. And I don't want to obey him. And so what you first took for joy, now you're saying, I don't like. I'm not going to follow him. That is because you have a superficial knowledge of him. If you truly understood what those rules were about, then you would be happy to follow those rules because you would see his heart in it. In order to really know him, we also have to have experiences with him. We have to be able to look back on our lives from before now and see, oh, God was actually working this entire time and I had no idea. Now I see how he was putting things in place to make this work out for me in a way that I had no idea at the time. Even before I knew him, he was working on my behalf. He was protecting me in that way. He was setting things in motion for me to get that job or meet that person or whatever the case may be. And then from this point forward, we have to pray to him and look for his answers. Look for him working on our behalf. Look for where he's leading us, what he's doing, so that we can have experiences with him. When you pray that prayer and then you see God do something that is an answer to that prayer, whether it's a no or a wait or a yes, or I'm doing all of these things or wait, all of that, when you see that and you know about that, and now it's happening, that must be God, then you've just had an experience with Him. And then you trust Him more. Then your faith grows. When you read His Word and you see things that give you an understanding of the things that you didn't understand before, instead of saying, I don't like that, go to them and say, God, what is going on? I don't understand this. Help me understand this. And then begin to read His words. That's Him speaking to you. That is Him explaining certain things to you. Go to Him in prayer and say, help me understand. And then He'll show you things in His Word. He will speak to your spirit and you will begin to understand things that you don't understand. You'll begin to have an acceptance of things that you may not still fully understand, but you trust Him like a parent. You know that He has only goodness for you because you know Him, you know His heart, and you know that He would never do anything bad for you. And so you learn to trust Him. You learn to know more about Him. This is what it looks like to know God on a deep, personal, intimate, experiential level, right? And we need all of that. We need every single bit of that knowledge of Him in order to keep us faithful. Because what did I say in my blog post last week? I was talking about marriage and staying faithful to a spouse. And when we promise to love and cherish that person, then if we're living up to that promise, then we will never, ever cheat on them because we love them and we cherish them. And if we can begin to love God, then we won't stray from Him. But how do we love somebody we don't know? How do you love someone you don't even know? You just know about Him and the things that you know about Him, good, bad, whatever I can do with or without Him. But when you really, really get to know God, you love Him. And once you love Him, then you'll follow Him. Then you will stay faithful to Him. And so it all begins with knowledge. It all begins with knowing Him better. That is our greatest desire. First, we have to know Him. Awana's motto, I may have told y'all this before, but I love it because their entire desire is to get people to know God. Their motto is know, love, serve, because they believe that if you get to know God, you will love Him. And once you love Him, you'll want to serve Him. And so their entire purpose is to get you to know God more. And so they teach children Bible verses so that they can know God. These are His words. This is how you get to know His character, who He is, what He says, and understand more about Him. And I think we kind of get these things backwards sometimes. We think that we're supposed to serve Him like the Joshua's generation knew Him and they served Him because they really knew Him. Their children just knew like the rules that they were supposed to follow. And that isn't enough. That didn't compel them to follow Him because they didn't understand God's heart behind it. And we're not going to follow God's rules faithfully if we don't really love Him. Don't try to keep the list. Keep the list of things. Do all the things that God says to do because you won't be able to. Start with knowing Him. Once I know Him better and I spend more time with Him, those fruits just are naturally produced. It's not work anymore. It's not a burden keeping the law, because the more time I spend with Him, the more I just act like Him. The more I get to know Him, the more I love Him, the more I want to serve Him, the more I understand about Him, and it makes sense, and I want to do what He says. And then it all just falls into place. It's not work anymore. That's what it means to have a personal, experiential relationship with God. And that's what I want for everybody. That is why I teach the Bible. That's why I teach the Bible, because I want you to know the God that I know, because I believe fully that if you can know him and really see who he is and really understand him, then you will love him. And if you love him, you're going to want to do what he says. You're not going to want to disappoint him. You're going to begin to spend more and more time with him, and then you're going to produce these fruits naturally. So that is my prayer for everyone listening and everyone in the world, is to just get to know God better. So I hope that this has inspired you to be more like the Joshua generation, not to be like their children that don't have experiences with God, that don't have a deep relationship with him, where everything is just superficial. Seek to know him today. Don't be passive about it. You won't stay faithful. You won't keep his commands. You won't do what he wants you to do. You won't look like him. You can't do it without being committed and staying close to him. You have to get to know him better in order to be faithful to him, in order to love him and want to be faithful to him. So that is our lesson today. Next week, we will learn about the first three judges in this book. So make sure you subscribe so you don't miss that episode. Also, go to Substack. You can get free blog posts there. You can also subscribe, and you can get these written lessons there with all of the extra verses that I didn't read to you here, and then all of the references. And then follow me on social media. I'll be sending out scriptures for that. And then just join me next week. Thanks, and have a good day.